Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, as Republicans prepare to repeal Obamacare, Massachusetts Democrats in Washington vow to fight. But what can they do?
We have a situation here where the Republicans are willing to push the American people out of the airplane with no parachute.
Also today, regulating legal marijuana, a higher minimum wage, and the liberal agenda in Massachusetts. We'll hear from Senate President Stan Rosenberg on his legislative priorities for the new year. Plus, from the hard courts of Roxbury, religion, hip-hop, and the power of basketball.
You get a false sense of self living in the streets because you have to protect yourself from the violence. And so the court represented a place of safety.
It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but damn the game if it don't mean nothing.
And the New England Patriots rode to the Super Bowl. All that coming up this hour on Radio Boston.
She's got game, we got game, they got game.
First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin today with state politics and Beacon Hill's legislative agenda for the new year. Among the top issues lawmakers are expected to take on in the coming months, a push for a higher minimum wage, how to slow galloping health care costs, how to reform the criminal justice system. And despite the state's strong economy, they'll face a budget gap and difficult choices on spending. Joshua Miller covers politics for the Boston Globe and has his finger on the Beacon Hill pulse and joins us now. Welcome, Joshua. Good to have you.
So glad to be with you, Anthony.
And Happy New Year.
And to you.
So let's begin with marijuana, which voters legalized for recreational use in November. Legislators delayed the opening date for recreational marijuana by stores by 6 months. So what are the main issues that lawmakers need to work out here?
Yeah, there's a lot they're going to be addressing going forward in these next few months, and they'll be doing it quickly because the time is limited. Now, to begin, proponents who wrote the measure, which passed with about 1.8 million votes, say it is a comprehensive, implementable law that will protect public health and safety and has already ended more than 100 years of failed prohibition. Indeed, possessing and using marijuana became legal on December 15th. But legislative leaders think it has some big holes. First, as you said, they expanded the time frame, so recreational pot shops aren't expected to open until July of 2018, and they said that was to give them more time to make so-called fixes to the law and make new laws to complement it. One of the first big items I suspect they'll address is about driving high on marijuana. Mm-hmm. Now, that's already illegal, but there's no bright-line standard like there is for alcohol, so if you have a blood alcohol level of 0.08 or more, you're driving drunk. There's no metric like that for marijuana, for THC, the main psychoactive chemical in marijuana, and that, cops say, can make policing high driving really tough. One other area is edibles, those pot-infused candies, cookies, savory treats that make up a big chunk of the recreational market in states like Colorado and Washington. And there's a lot of worry from policymakers that manufacturers here might sell edibles that are attractive to kids, or that have so much THC, that psychoactive pot chemical in them, that it makes people sick and they don't know how much they're getting.
I see. So some stuff to work out there. I want to move on and talk about the minimum wage. As of January 1st, the state's minimum wage went up to $11 an hour. That's the final raise from a law passed in 2014. But as you reported today, there's a move to push it up to $15. What are the arguments in favor, and how do you expect this to play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think advocates say that $11 an hour is a good sort of first step in creating more equality of incomes, but it's not enough to live on. And a living wage would really be looking at something more like a minimum wage of $15 an hour. And the same advocates who tirelessly pushed for the raise to $11 an hour are sort of expected to be doing something towards $15 an hour this legislative session. And they've already threatened that if lawmakers don't act, they'll go to the ballot and pass it through the people. Obviously, business groups are really concerned about that, and they say if they have to pay everyone more, it's going to simply mean, especially in businesses that hire a lot of minimum wage people, they're just going to be able to hire fewer people, and that'll mean higher unemployment and some people who don't have any access to an income.
All right, so familiar debate there. Let's move on and talk about health care spending. It continues to increase. The legislature passed a law a while back to try to put the brakes on the rise of health care costs. It has increased more in the last 2 years than legislators wanted. What are lawmakers proposing to do now?
Well, there are a lot of different ways to go at it, and it'll be interesting to see which ones they take up. They haven't given a lot of details, but I think there's an acknowledgement that given that per capita health spending in the state increased 4.2% in 2014, about the same in 2015, it's not really a sustainable rise because inflation is so much less than that, and healthcare costs eat up more and more of the state budget as a percentage every year. So I think they might try to go back to the drawing board and see how they can work off that law they passed a few years ago to try to rein in those healthcare costs. But the specifics of it really are TBD.
When we talk about legislative agendas, it's all about spending. And I want to ask you about this, about the state budget. I mean, this is a state, as you pointed out this morning in the Globe, that enjoys a pretty strong economy, low unemployment. And yet the state continues to deal with one budget gap after another, requiring Governor Baker to impose three rounds of emergency budget cuts since he took office in 2015. There's a new fiscal year coming up in the summer. What accounts for these budget gaps, and do we expect another one, and how are legislators going to respond to that?
Anthony, all depends on your view and the people's view. Liberals say the reason that we keep facing these budget gaps is there's simply not enough revenue. There's not enough money to pay for the services that Massachusetts people want. They point to tax cuts imposed by voters by a referendum in 2000 and several other tax cuts along the way. But conservatives say, you know, Massachusetts has a bloated bureaucracy with tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of employees. It could be cut down to size, and we don't need to raise taxes. We need to just rein in government spending. Now, another issue, whether you're conservative or liberal, another issue that definitely has played a role in this is those health care costs. Medicaid, the joint federal-state health care program for the poor, has eaten up more and more and more of the budget in every year, sort of going back all the way 10, 20, 30 years. So there's less and less room to spend on other things. But whatever the reason is for these budget gaps, that's something legislators and Governor Charlie Baker are going to have to address in the months ahead, definitely.
Well, one last question, and it's about Governor Charlie Baker. He's halfway through his first term. Polls show he's enormously popular. He has a great working relationship with the Democratic leaders on Beacon Hill. What do you foresee in the months ahead? I mean, he could be gearing up for re-election soon enough. I mean, is that kind of congenial attitude up there on Beacon Hill likely to survive? What's your view?
I think it's very likely to survive. I think it's to his benefit and to the benefit of the Democratic House Speaker, Bob DeLeo, and the Democratic Senate President, Stan Rosenberg, to keep a working relationship. Whether it is to the benefit of the Democratic Party overall is a broader question. It'll be interesting to see, especially next year when Baker's expected to be facing voters in November of 2018, whether the relationship breaks down a little bit. But for now, they've all had kind words for each other. They've worked together on big pieces of legislation, like the one addressing the opioid crisis. And I expect that to continue definitely in the beginning months of this year. We'll see how it unfolds as the election grows nearer and nearer.
Well, we'll see how it unfolds, and we always appreciate doing that with you. That's Joshua Miller. He covers politics for the Boston Globe, talking about the legislative agenda for the coming months. Joshua, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We've been reaching out to state leaders to hear about their priorities on key issues over the next 2 years. So we're joined now by Senate President Stan Rosenberg, who just won re-election earlier today. And Mr. Senate President, welcome to Radio Boston, and congratulations on your re-election.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you. So you outlined some of your legislative agenda today. What's on top of your list? What's your top priority?
So I would say education, transportation, criminal justice reform, and continuing to modernize the operations of the legislature so we can get legislation, quality legislation, done more quickly. I tried to point out that, as happened with Uber and Lyft, where for about 5 years they were unregulated in the state, and then we did regulation, and that was after taxis had been in place and regulated in this Commonwealth for probably 100 years or more. And so their regulation and their government involvement evolved over literally generations, where Uber sprung upon the scene, and within 4 or 5 years we had to do regulation, and we did it. And the ink is barely dry on the legislation, and now we have autonomous vehicles through which Uber and Lyft are likely to be sending you driverless cars instead of an Uber with a driver in it to pick you up. So, and we're going to have to come up with rules and regulations and law around that, and it's going to open up a whole series of public policy questions around liability and insurance and transportation finance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so literally in less than 10 years, we will have visited two disruptive technologies related to demand response transportation, where in the 100 years before that, we had a pretty stable system that had developed over time and sort of managed to sort of be pretty much the same for most of that time.
It sounds like that really requires a different way of thinking for you lawmakers.
Totally does. We have to have a longer-term vision, and we have to move more quickly. And we have to be prepared to not kick the can down the road, but to pick up the challenges and move with them more quickly. And it's not limited to these technology pieces. Education, we haven't made we did a 20-year education reform plan in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, and it worked very well, but we're in a new time, and we haven't made a multi-year commitment to a vision for public education and funding in decades.
Let me ask you about education. With relationship to this, voters defeated question two quite soundly. That would have greatly expanded the number of charter schools in the state. You said that that signaled the need for education 2.0, which would focus on all kids. So what does that look like?
Correct.
What is education 2.0?
2.0 looks like a multi-year commitment for education finance for all of the children, not just the 4 or 5% of the children who are in charter schools and maybe 7 or 8% that might be in charter schools a decade from now. So we need to look at all of the children. We've also got to continue to modernize, and we've got to have universal childhood, early childhood education. Doesn't all have to be paid for by the government, but for income-eligible families, there's 26,000 kids on a waiting list. Those kids, if they get into early childhood education and that's successful, they have a better chance of reading at grade level by the fourth grade than if they don't have that help and opportunity. And if they succeed in reading at grade level by the fourth grade, their chances of success in the rest of their education skyrocket. And so it's that kind of long-term thinking that went on in the early 90s when we made a multi-year commitment to pretty much double public funding for education over a seven-year period, and we kept that promise, but we stalled, and we've got to get back on track.
Well, last year's Senate measure on education didn't get a vote in the House. Given the defeat, following the defeat of question two, why would this year be any different in terms of getting a compromise through the full legislature?
We have a responsibility to look to the future and make sure that we're addressing two of the fundamental pillars of our economy, which is an educated workforce and a transportation system that supports getting goods and people to where they need to be as efficiently as possible, and preferably in a way that reduces our carbon footprint and our impact on climate change. So all of those things blend together, and there is an opportunity for the voters to push us in this direction, if you will, because if the fair share tax plan is approved by the voters in 2018, when it appears on the ballot, they will provide the wherewithal for us to be able to fund a robust multi-year commitment for pre-K through higher ed, as well as for transportation improvements.
Now, fair share tax plan, for our listeners who might not be up to date, remind us what that is. That would be a tax on millionaires, correct?
It would be a tax on millionaires, similar to what was done in California, one of our most, one of the states we compete against most for companies and for investment in high tech and life sciences, et cetera. So they've made a very strong commitment to making sure that they have the revenue they need to support education and other governmental programs that support the economy. Every business person I talk to talks to me about four things, and some combination of the four: education, transportation, affordable housing, and filling the skills gap, because there's 100,000 jobs sitting vacant on any given day and 100,000 people unemployed, because there's a mismatch between their skills and the openings The jobs stay vacant and the people stay unemployed.
Mm. So let me ask you about an issue that's somewhat related to this, and that is the effort to further raise the minimum wage. You were key to increasing it to $11 an hour, which went into effect just 3 days ago. Massachusetts now has the highest minimum wage in the country. Several unions and community groups are pushing for a $15 minimum wage. Do you think that's feasible for Massachusetts?
A number of other states have already adopted a $15 minimum wage going out 3 or 4 years. New York and California would be two examples of that. So, again, the states with which we compete the most are recognizing that if you don't put enough money into the paychecks of the workers, they don't have the income to spend and to support their small businesses, et cetera, which helps with the economy, but it also has them struggling to pay their own bills, in which case they have to turn to the government for fuel and food and rental and health care assistance, all of which is then passed on to other taxpayers in order to subsidize. So this is a matter of coming up with a rational, thoughtful plan to gradually increase so that a minimum wage becomes gets high enough to be a truly livable wage and people can stop having to turn to the government for programs and services to supplement their income because they go to work, sometimes 2 and 3 jobs, work 50, 60, 70 hours a week, and they still don't make enough money to support their family.
Yeah, no, it's a huge challenge, clearly, for families. But what do you say to the businesses who say that a higher minimum wage forces them to hold off on hiring or consider moving altogether to states where the minimum wage would be lower?
So most of the states where they'd want to move are also looking at increasing the minimum wage. Oh. And it's really a question of doing this carefully and gradually, as we just did moving to $11 an hour. We did that $1 a year over 3 years. Businesses were able to plan. And yes, there can be, and there isn't always, but there can be some small dislocation in the economy during that transition. But it's usually when you have that first increment, because the other two increments in this case, they could plan for and they could adjust and adjust their operating budgets and their operating and their strategies to be able to accommodate what is they were going to need to do. You know, we have the third highest per capita income in the country here in Massachusetts, a very high quality and standard of living, and this is the kind of place you want to live in, the kinds of places that a lot of people say they would move to, they wouldn't actually move in the end because they would not want to live there and run their businesses there. They won't want to raise their families there, et cetera. So this is about the government working cooperatively with the business community, coming up with sensible strategy to be able to phase this in carefully and appropriately so that we cause the minimum of dislocation. And remember, every dollar that goes into somebody's paycheck, if you're making $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year, goes right back into the economy.
I want to ask you a sort of more general question about the nature of governing these days in Massachusetts. And unlike lawmakers in Washington, D.C., Massachusetts has been notable for the way Democrats, like you, in the legislature work with a Republican governor. Do you expect that to continue this year? Because Baker could well be gearing up for a re-election. Some members of your own party would like to see a more forceful challenge to Baker. What's your view on this?
So I think we will continue to have disagreements, but we will do so without being disagreeable. The governor and I have had a conversation about this. I said, look, we have two hats. We have the hat which we wear at least 9 to 5 every day, which is when we're doing policy and governing. And then we have the hat that we have to put on during the election year, where on the evenings and the weekends we're going to be out there campaigning. We need to be able to differentiate and separate what we do and recognize that when we're working in this building, we're working together to find common ground, build solutions that will help the people of the Commonwealth. And it isn't about partisanship. It's about getting the best result. When we go on the campaign trail, of course, we're going to be loyal to our parties and to our party's ideas. And we may even say a few things here and there that might sting a little, but that's on the political side of it. As long as overall we recognize and remember we're here to work together to serve the people, we're going to be able to have another good term as we did this past.
All right. Well, that's Massachusetts Senate President Stan Rosenberg, a Democrat from Amherst. Mr. Senate President, thanks again for joining us, and congratulations on your reelection today. And
thank you so much.
And Happy New Year.
Look forward to being with you again in the future. Well, Take care.
We always enjoy having you. Thank you, sir. And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In a little more than 2 weeks, Donald Trump will become president, but Republicans are already trying to make good on his campaign promise to kill Obamacare, which has extended health insurance to more than 20 million Americans. On Capitol Hill today, Vice President-elect Mike Pence met with House Republicans to talk about how to kill the law. Before that, President Obama met with congressional Democrats to talk about how to save it. Here's Pence speaking to reporters earlier today.
Our president-elect took his case to the American people to repeal and replace Obamacare, and the American people voted decisively for a better future for health care in this country. And we are determined to give them that.
Among the members of Congress who met with President Obama was Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark. And welcome back to Radio Boston, Congresswoman Clark. Always good to have you.
Thank you for having me on, Anthony.
So we heard Vice President-elect Pence there. What strategy did the president lay out to you Democrats to try to preserve the Affordable Care Act?
So the president today came and spoke to us, perhaps for the last time in his presidency. And really, he emphasized the work that we have been able to do together to help the American people. And it certainly includes greatly expanded access to health care that still polls incredibly high. And what we're seeing from the Republicans, what we're seeing from the clip you just played, is they are pushing ahead with their plan that they call repeal and replace. But after 7 years of talking about it, they still have no plan for how to continue accessible health care for the American people.
And yet it does seem as though they have a plan to dismantle the ACA, and they've already begun through budget legislation, which they can do with a simple majority. So what can the Democrats do to stop that, given that you are in the minority?
Well, we have a situation here where the Republicans are willing to push the American people out of the airplane with no parachute. And we have to be constantly talking about working with our constituents, reaching out with this message to American families that we are not going to stand for this. And we are in the minority, but we have constituents and we have the opinion of American families behind us. There has been a lot of misinformation given about the ACA, but the truth of the matter is it is working for people. It is making sure that families who had pre-existing conditions can now be covered. It has extended catastrophic care for millions and millions of Americans, and we're seeing a cynical, not fact-based campaign to repeal the ACA, to keep a campaign promise without any kind of plan for how they are not going to create chaos for Americans who need health care coverage.
Well, Vice President-elect Mike Pence promised what he called an orderly transition to a market-based health care system. I'm wondering, is there any common ground with the new administration regarding whatever would follow the Affordable Care Act? Do you see any common ground?
It's hard to identify common ground because they haven't produced a single plan or a single idea of what they are going to replace the ACA with. So it's impossible to know.
Well, this leads to a more general question about how you and your fellow Democrats will approach a Trump administration. I'm thinking that from day one of the Obama administration, the Republican leadership made it pretty clear that their number one priority would be to oppose Obama. And arguably, they won with that strategy last November. Given that history, is that a sensible course for Democrats to follow? Or do you risk becoming the party of no?
The only course for us to follow, and I think that I can assure you that the Democratic caucus in the House is united in this, is to work for American families. And if the Trump administration makes proposals that work for American families, we're going to support them. But we are going to hold him accountable. He said after his election he would be a president for all Americans. And that means that you continue to fight for accessible health care. You continue to make sure that women are paid equally as men. You continue to look at child care, which is one of the leading expenses for families with young children. And you continue to work with us to battle this epidemic of opiate addiction. If the Trump administration shows that it truly intends to work for Americans, then we will join him. But until then, we will hold him accountable. And every day, we see that he is making appointments and statements that shows he is not intending to fulfill that promise.
Congresswoman, you introduced a bill at the end of the last Congress, the Presidential Accountability Act, which would require the president to separate himself from his business interests. Lawmakers didn't vote on it in the last session. So will you reintroduce that this session? And do you think it can pass?
I am reintroducing it probably this week. And I think you can see from the outreach yesterday where our office and offices across Capitol Hill were deluged with calls.
You're talking about the House Republicans' effort to essentially gut the ethics office, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They were so outraged by this move under the darkness of night by the Republicans to do away with independent oversight of the Ethics Committee that, you know, they actually ended up walking it back. And I think that that same outrage is going to follow. I think people are giving Trump a chance to do the right thing here, to do the ethical, honest thing, and show the American people he is in the White House to work for them and not to line his own pockets. And until he does that, like every other president in the modern presidency has done voluntarily, the American people are not going to settle. And this particular, with the wide business holdings that the president-elect has such potential for true corruption, the appearance of corruption, and constitutional violations. And I think with the small glimpse we saw of the outrage that was generated when the Republicans tried to pull back on ethics oversight is only going to be magnified if President Trump does not address his business holdings.
All right. Well, that's Catherine Clark. She represents the Massachusetts 5th Congressional District. And Congresswoman Clark, thanks again for joining us. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Anthony. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And moving now from politics to that other contact sport, football. With their crushing defeat of the Miami Dolphins this past weekend, the New England Patriots finished their regular season with 14 wins and just 2 losses and are now the number one seed in the AFC. Not bad for a team that lost its powerhouse tight end, Ron Gronkowski, to a season-ending injury and that began the season without its star quarterback, Tom Brady, because of a 4-game Deflategate suspension. And that's where we'll begin our weekly talk about sports with Shira Springer, WBUR sports and society reporter. Hi, Shira.
Hello.
Good to have you. So with Deflategate behind them, Brady firmly in charge, how does this team look to you?
Looks very good. As I understand, Nate Silver's latest Super Bowl predictions have the Patriots as the heavy favorites. So if all goes well, there are some finger crossings to be done and some knocking on wood to be done. And if, you know, to make sure players stay injury free. But it looks like a fairly easy path to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, in fact, I was reading a story on Fox News which says, quote, the New England Patriots have the easiest path to the Super Bowl. Do you agree? Famous last words?
I'm finding some wood to knock on right now. I agree. I mean, it looks like they're going to have to face either the Kansas City Chiefs or the Pittsburgh Steelers, two very tough opponents. No doubt you never should underestimate Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger. But they only have to face one of those teams. They don't have to face them both in a row on two separate weekends. Additionally, the big thing for them is they have home field field advantage throughout the AFC playoffs, something they did not have last year and something they paid for dearly when they went out to Denver to play the Broncos in the AFC Championship game. There may be no tougher place to play than at altitude in Denver, and they learned that or remembered that or were reminded of that the hard way and didn't reach the Super Bowl last year.
Shira, is there any part of you that's surprised where the Patriots are today, given how this season began with Tom Brady's suspension, missing the first four games?
No, actually, because I think if you look at Brady and his career, I mean, don't forget, this is the sixth round draft pick from 2000. He has made a career out of proving people wrong, out of defying expectations, out of overcoming the odds. And I also think people felt that, you know, if they got through that four-game suspension, maybe at 2-2, maybe at 3-1, if they were lucky, and which they were, they got through at 3-1, they'd be okay with once Brady came back. What has surprised me a little bit is how well they have adjusted post-Gronkowski. Rob Gronkowski got injured. He's out for the remainder of the season, but it really seems like they haven't missed a beat. I believe they've won, I think it is 7 games to end the season. So they seem like they're just in a really good stretch and have a really good momentum heading into the playoffs.
Good time to be peaking. So,
yes.
All right. So let's turn from Gillette to the Garden, where the Celtics played last night and beat the Utah Jazz. They're 21-14, second in the Atlantic Division. How are they looking so far this season, with a month and a half until the All-Star weekend in February?
They're looking good. I mean, I think people had some higher expectations for them, but I think overall, you know, they could make it be a dangerous team in the playoffs, and that's sort of what you're playing for when you're in the NBA.
All right. Now, there was a kind of strange incident last night where Celtics fans cheered an opposing player on the Utah team during introductions. Shira, what happened here?
Yeah, it was a bit strange. Fans of the Garden did cheer Utah Jazz forward Gordon Hayward during lineup introductions. And you have to understand that Hayward is a potential free agent this upcoming offseason. So there may be a number of Celtics fans who covet Hayward, want to see him in a Celtics uniform next season. And Crowder didn't take this well. He was quite upset after the game. He tweeted about it, and he let it be known that he felt disrespected. In fact, he said this to ESPN.
I heard it cheered before the game. I ain't like that at all.
Yeah.
And it was a sign of disrespect to me from the fans. That sparked a little fire in me.
Yeah, so that did motivate you.
Of course.
And you, 5 3-pointers tied a career high, right? What was going on there?
To be aggressive.
Yeah.
So I just felt disrespected.
So I felt disrespected. Be aggressive. He ties a career high and goes out and shoots a 5 3-pointer. So I guess it sort of put the fire in his belly, right?
Yeah, I think the Celtics fans have accidentally stumbled upon something. The way to motivate Jay Crowder is to disrespect him, because he'll have one of the best, if not the best, games of the season.
That's amazing. Well, listen, bring us back here to Massachusetts, a bit of a bright spot in Shrewsbury, where a basketball coach there has set a record for the most victories in New England high school basketball history. Tell us about this.
Yeah, congratulations to Shrewsbury coach Bob Foley. He picked up his 879th career win on Tuesday. And I just think it's a lovely story, because you love to see these coaches at the high school level sticking around long term and taking these young boys and teaching them the important lessons in life and winning while they do that. It's a nice story, particularly when there have been some sports stories of late that have been tinged with some hard news to stomach.
Really, 879 win. One wonders, though, in Shrewsbury if they know anything about losing now and then. I mean, that's
an
important
lesson,
too.
I don't think so. It certainly doesn't seem like it.
All right, well, that's Shira Springer, sports and society reporter for WBUR. Shira, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. 17 years ago, Onaje Woodbine was living the dream. He grew up poor in Boston, honed his basketball talents on the hard courts of Roxbury, and ended up playing for Yale, where he was the lead scorer and among the best in the Ivy League. Then, during his sophomore year, he quit because he wanted more. He wanted a life of the mind, to keep out of a system that valued young black men as profitable athletic workers. That led him back to the basketball courts in Roxbury, to a doctorate of philosophy at BU, and to Phillips Academy in Andover, where he teaches philosophy and religious studies. Last May, Onaje Woodbine published a book about the power of basketball and his journey called Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip-Hop, and Street Basketball. So let's listen back to that interview. Woodbine talked first about the role that basketball played in his life when he was a young man.
When I was 12 years old, I lost my coach and mentor who was like a father to me. Early on, I didn't have a father in my life. Later on, we reconnected, but during those early years, I really, you know, needed a male role model in my life. And he was really the person who stood out for me. And he passed away. Mm. He was in a car accident. He was a police officer, Boston police officer, and he lost his life that day. And, you know, I went to the basketball court to sort of find him. You know, I remember the next day going to the court and shooting around and you know, I was asking myself, what happens when you die? You know, where do you go? Where is Manny? And, you know, the court was the place where I felt most comfortable asking those kinds of questions.
Hmm. Now, why is that? What did the court offer you at that time?
Well, you know, in the streets, as a young black man, you have to have wear a certain mask. You know, you have to look tough. You have to walk with a certain style that is really, you know, you get a false sense of self living in the streets because you have to protect yourself from the violence. And so the court represented a place of safety. It represented a place where I could question, where I felt like I was a human being, where I felt love, you know, from my peers. And so I think it was just a natural place for me to share those emotions of pain and grief and to ask those kinds of, you know, deep human questions.
And in your case, at that point in your life, it was also a place where you could express a certain amount of athletic talent and identity, right?
Well, definitely. You know, growing up in the inner city, there are three sort of identity options for young black men. There are others, but, you know, the main ones are either you're a ball player, a rapper, or a gang member. And, you know, I was blessed to be able to have the talent to play ball because the gang members would leave you alone. They'd give you a pass. They, you know, they'd say, you know, this young man, he represents the hope of this community. And so we don't want him to participate in the violence. So to have that talent and that identity, it meant everything. It meant the difference between life and death for me.
Yeah. So you end up making this remarkable journey from the hard courts of Roxbury to Yale University. And what's striking about what you write about that experience is you were a star. You were successful, as we said in the introduction, by many measures, you were living the dream. But you encountered some dramatic disappointment there.
Definitely. I reconnected with my father when I was 15 years old, and he taught me that I already had everything I needed within me, that all I had to do was listen to that still small voice. And I carried that with me on the court. The basketball game became a moving meditation for me, and I carried that to Yale. And it was shocking to me that coaches and, you know, athletic administrators didn't value that they didn't encourage that or seek to cultivate or foster that kind of self-exploration amongst athletes. You know, we were treated like laborers and, you know, we were there to work and, you know, it was like a job. And at Yale, you know, the reason why I went to Yale was because I thought they would foster the life of the mind and the body. And I discovered that, you know, the body was emphasized over the mind.
You wrote something that really, really struck me about this particular topic. I'm just going to read it. Even though my inner city coaches were often less educated, they saw hoops as an extension of our lives in which players' deepest thought and everyday struggles played a significant role. How ironic it was then to discover that one of the greatest institutions of learning in the world, coaches built a tacit but impenetrable wall between athletics and the life of the mind.
It's
so beautifully expressed and so sad and disappointing.
It really was. I mean, the word coach was sacred, you know, where I came from. That was the person who told you, you know, if you don't do your homework, if you don't read, you know, your papers, you can't get on this court. You know, you know, this game is meant to elevate your mind and your spirit. And so to find that, you know, at Yale, you know, we practice for 4 hours a day, that, you know, we never discussed issues of dealing with either society or the life of the mind or character. It came as a huge shock to me, and particularly when I discovered a lot of misogyny and racism in the locker room. You know, racial division as well. Many, you know, the white players, most of them, especially my first year, were in a fraternity which none of the black players belonged, and there was silence on racial issues. And it was quite depressing to realize that the game that I had loved and given all of my heart to had become a corporation.
Mm. And it's quite striking, too, the way you describe sort of the role of talented black males within this corporation, that they're sort of seen as essentially black athletic workers.
Well, certainly that's the myth of slavery, you know, that sort of black men are extremely sound in body, right, that they have this almost primitive athletic ability, but that it comes along with a defective mind. And, you know, I think that racial myth, it does push these young men to the court. Poverty does push, you know, young African-American men to the court as well. But, you know, my thesis is that once they arrive there, there's agency, right? Mm-hmm. They're moving their bodies with each other, and they're gaining access to a mode of release from the culture. So it's this paradox.
Yeah. So you decided to quit, and I gather this was probably shocking to your coaches. And there's quite an amazing story about the reaction of one of your coaches, right?
Definitely. One of my coaches, who was a white assistant coach, somebody who I had thought, you know, had my best interests in mind the entire year. You know, once I decided to exercise my own freedom and agency, he wrote me a pretty nasty letter claiming that I had been admitted to Yale simply on the basis of my athletic ability and that I owed the university something. And, you know, what really shocked me is that he made the claim that Yale only admitted black players, black students, if they were athletes.
Yeah. And there was a suggestion that you'll be sort of letting down the prospects of future black students if you quit.
Well, right. You know, he tried to sort of hoist the burden of my race, you know, on my shoulders, as if, you know, my leaving the team would hurt the chances of other black students gaining admission to Yale.
Yeah. How did you react to that at the time?
You know, at the time, I was angry, I was saddened, I was shocked. But, you know, again, listening to that inner voice, I eventually forgave him. Mm-hmm. You know, I forgave him because I felt like it was a systemic issue. It was a cultural issue. There's so much pressure on coaches for winning. And, you know, the issues of race and gender and class aren't discussed in these contexts. And so I wrote him a letter just asking him to rethink, you know, his letter. And, you know, and I just wished him well. And to this day, you know, I hope that our conversations and interactions have sort of changed him for the better.
You know, Onaje, there's such an interesting sort of dichotomy at the heart of your story, because the sort of power of the court early in your life begins with this idea that it's almost an expression of personal identity and freedom. And then you travel in a way to the top, at least in terms of college athletics, which is pretty high up, and the court becomes a kind of prison of expectation because you are a black person. So it's anything but an expression of freedom.
Well, yes, you know, that's the double consciousness. You know, on the one hand, you know, African Americans, we see ourselves through the eyes of others and, you know, the dominant culture. And on the other hand, there's something behind the veil. There's freedom. There's agency. You know, good players don't simply play by the rules, right? Mm-hmm. They don't go to the court to be exploited. And part of the problem with social science and a lot of the literature out there on black masculinity in sports is that they view these young men as simply passive participants in the game, right? And it's ironic because they set aside the subjective experience they have on the court, you know? And so what I try to do is say, yes, you know, there is exploitation, but the lived experience, right, that subjectivity, you know, meaning is important for human beings, and these are human beings creating meaning.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about what you went through writing this book. You spent 4 years studying street basketball in Boston, so in a sense you came back home. You interviewed dozens of young men. What brought you back? I mean, what made you want to write the book?
Yeah, so it was a healing process for me. It really was. I felt survivor's guilt, you know, after leaving Roxbury and entering the Ivy League. In order to do that, I had to leave my community behind in many ways. You know, I was entering a culture which was so different from theirs. And so for me to return, it gave me a sense of wholeness. You know, I was able to see people and to mourn with people and to ask for forgiveness, you know, for people who I left behind. And so
forgiveness for leaving them behind?
Or yeah, you know, because there were funerals that I didn't go to, you know, and there were mothers that I felt like raised me and that I didn't speak to for 5 or 10 years, you know. And so, you know, going back and then going onto the court and seeing some of the guys that I had left behind and being able to rub my body next to theirs and share that love, I mean, it was a journey in my own healing process.
I'd love to hear a story about one of these guys that you came back to, as you say, to rub your body up against theirs on the basketball court. I mean, what did you hear?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the first interviews I had was with a young man named Shorty, and he was a god to me growing up. You know, the way that he dribbled the ball, he dribbled over his head. In the NBA, would have been a travel, you know, but he had this street ball style that was just uncanny. And I just, watching him mesmerized me as a child, and I thought he would go into the NBA. And I hadn't heard about him for years. And so one of these days, I went back to Roxbury as I was writing the book, and I saw him on the court. And he still moved with the grace, you know, of a ballerina out there. And but what was so striking is that when I approached him, he couldn't look me in the eye. And I later found out that he had just been released from prison, and he was there to mourn his grandmother who died while he was in prison with his jump shot.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, I talked to him for hours, and we played together. And, you know, it just taught me so much about how young men are using the game to create meaning.
And if they do that successfully, it can be a truly transcendent sort of experience for them, right?
Certainly, yes. You know, in the streets, you know, your ego is so wrapped up in the violence and the distractions. Part of what ritual does, and the ritual of basketball does, it gives you a moment to place that assumption or that identity in abeyance, right? You can bracket it for a moment in time and look at it and see yourself, you know, and rework some of those things. And so it is a kind of transcendent experience. And, you know, oftentimes at the end of the game, if the ritual is really going well, there'll be this cathartic moment where they just let it all out. And sometimes there are witnesses on the sidelines that see those qualities in them. And it's just an amazing experience.
I'm wondering, though, about the danger, not so much the danger, but that is for people who can really take this game to a high level like you. There are few of you, and most people playing on the hard courts of Roxbury aren't going to go to that level. They need, I don't know, somehow can you provide a sort of reality check and sort of say, when we're talking about transcendence, we're not necessarily talking about fortunes in the NBA. We're talking about the kind of spiritual transcendence that you just described.
Right, right. Well, yes, you know, this needs to be sort of done, choreographed consciously.
Yeah.
Right? We need to choreograph these rituals. And that's why elders are so important around these spaces. And much of this is done unconsciously, right? Yeah. Somebody gets shot, right? Just like I did when I was younger, right? But, you know, guys that I interviewed, a friend gets shot and killed, they go to the court and they mourn that person, but they don't really realize what they're doing, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, if we can get our elders to show up at these spaces and choreograph this consciousness, right, intentionally, right, then I think, you know, we have something.
That was Onaje Woodbine, author of Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip Hop, and Street Basketball, recorded last May. He teaches philosophy and religious studies at Phillips Academy, Andover. And that's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show was produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Cassandra Sunt and Ashley Bailey. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.